hate ghost schools and things that go bump in the night. I'm sorry I had to ditch you guys for a couple weeks. There was this whole thing, ancient prophecies, scrolls, but like the good news is I'm gonna have some super cool stories to tell you. I'm not quite ready yet though. I'm still processing, you know? But during my travels, I did find this really neat old ghost story that I couldn't wait to share with you guys. So, consider this a little sneak peek of the things to come. I missed you guys. Thanks for sticking with us, and I hope you're ready to sit back, relax, and tune in for the oh-so-wonderfully titled story, A Ghost. We were speaking of Sequestrin, alluding to a recent lawsuit. It was at the close of a friendly evening in a very old mansion, and each of the guests had a story to tell, which he assured us was true. Then the old Marquis, 82 years of age, rose and came forward to lean on the mantelpiece. He told the following story in his slightly quivering voice. I also have witnessed a strange thing, so strange it has become the nightmare of my life. It happened 56 years ago, and yet there is not a month when I do not see it again in my dreams. From that day, I have borne a mark, a stamp of fear. Do you understand? Yes, for 10 minutes, I was prey to terror, in which a way that would ever since a constant dread has remained in my soul. Unexpected sounds chill me to the heart. Objects which I can ill distinguish in the evening shadows make me long to flee. I am afraid at night. No, I would not have owned such a thing before reaching my present age. But now I may tell everything. One may fear imaginary dangers at 82 years old, but not before actual danger have I ever turned back. That affair so upset my mind, filled me with such a deep, mysterious unrest that I could never tell it. I kept it in that inmost part, that corner where we conceal our sad, our shameful secrets, all the weaknesses of our life which cannot be confessed. I will tell you that the strange happening, just as it took place, with no attempt to explain it. Unless I went mad for one short hour, it must be explainable, though. Yet I was not mad, and I will prove it to you. Imagine what you will. Here are the simple facts. It was in 1827, in July. I was quartered with my regiment. One day, as I was patrolling on the quay, I came across a man I believed I recognized, though I could not place him with certainty. I instinctively went more slowly, ready to pause. The stranger saw my impulse, looked at me, and fell into my arms. It was a friend of my younger days, of whom I had been very fond. He seemed to have become half a century older in the 5 years since I had last seen him. His hair was white, and he stooped in his walk as if he were exhausted. He understood my amazement and told me the story of his life. A terrible event had broken him down. He had fallen madly in love with a young girl and married her in a kind of dreamlike ecstasy. After a year of unallied bliss and unexhausted passion, she died suddenly of heart disease, no doubt killed by love itself. He had left the country on the very day of her funeral and had come to live in his hotel here. He remained there, solitary and desperate, grief slowly mining him, so wretched that he constantly thought of suicide. As thus I came upon you again, he said, I shall ask a great favor of you. I want you to go to my chateau and get some papers I urgently need. They're in the writing desk of my room, of our room. I cannot send a servant or a lawyer, as the errand must be kept private. I want absolute silence. I shall give you the key of the room, which I locked carefully myself before leaving, and the key to the writing desk. I shall also give you a note for the gardener, who will let you in. Come to breakfast with me tomorrow, and we'll talk the matter over. I promised to render him that slight service. It would mean but a pleasant excursion for me, his home not being more than 25 miles from mine. I could go there in an hour on horseback. At 10 o'clock the next day, I was with him. We breakfasted alone together, yet he did not utter more than 20 words. He asked me to excuse him. The thought that I was going to visit the room where his happiness lay shattered upset him, he said. Indeed, he seemed perturbed, worried, as if some of the mysterious struggle were taking place in his soul. At last, he explained exactly what I needed to do. It was very simple. I was to take 2 packages of letters and some papers, locked in the first drawer at the right of the desk of which I had a key. He added, "I need not ask you not to glance at them." I was almost hurt by his words, and told him so, rather sharply. He stammered, "Forgive me, I suffer so much," and tears came to his eyes. I left at about 1 o'clock to accomplish my errand. The day was radiant, and I rushed through the meadows, listening to the song of the larks and the rhythmical beat of my sword on my riding boots. Then I entered the forest, and I set my horse to walking. Branches of the trees softly caressed my face, and now and then I would catch a leaf between my teeth and bite it with avidity, full of the joy of life, such as fills you without reason, with a tumultuous happiness almost indefinable, a kind of magical strength. As I neared the house, I took out the letter for the gardener and noted with surprise that it was sealed. I was so amazed and so annoyed that I almost turned back without fulfilling my mission. Then I thought that I should thus display oversensitiveness and bad taste. My friend might have sealed it unconsciously, worried as he was. The manor looked as though it had been deserted the last 20 years. The gate, wide open and rotten, held, one wondered how. Grass filled the paths. You could not tell the flower beds from the lawn. At the noise I made kicking a shutter, an old man came out from a side door and was apparently amazed to see me there. I dismounted from my horse and gave him the letter. He read it over once or twice, looked at me with suspicion, and said, "Well, what do you want?" I answered sharply, "You must know, as you have read your master's orders, I want to get in the house." He appeared overwhelmed. He said, So you're going in his room?" I was getting impatient. "Do you intend to question me, by chance?" He stammered, No, monsieur, only it has not been opened since the death. If you'll wait 5 minutes, I'll go in and see whether..." I interrupted angrily. "See here, are you joking? You can't go in that room, as I have the key." He no longer knew what to say. "Then, monsieur, I will show you the way." "Show me the stairs and leave me alone. I can find it without your help." "But still, monsieur..." Then I lost my temper. "Now be quiet, else you'll be sorry." I roughly pushed him aside and went into the house. I first went through the kitchen, then crossed 2 small rooms occupied by the man and his wife. From there, I stepped into a large hall. I went up the stairs, and I recognized the door my friend had described to me. I opened it with ease and went in. The room was so dark that at first I could not distinguish anything. I paused, arrested by that moldy and stale odor peculiar to deserted and condemned rooms, of dead rooms. Then gradually my eyes grew accustomed to the gloom, and I saw rather clearly a great room in disorder. A bed without sheets, still having its mattress and pillows, one of which bore the deep print of an elbow or a head, as if someone had just been resting on it. The chair seemed all in confusion. I noticed that a door, probably that of a closet, had remained ajar. I first went to the window and opened it to get some light, but the hinges of the outside shutters were so rusted that I could not loosen them. I even tried to break them with my sword, but did not succeed. All these fruitless attempts irritated me, and as my eyes were by now adjusted to the dim light, I gave up hope in getting more light and went towards the writing desk. I sat down in an armchair, folded back the top, and opened the drawer. It was full to the edge. I needed but three packages, which I knew how to distinguish, and I started looking for them. I was straining my eyes to decipher the inscriptions, when I thought I heard, or rather felt, a rustle behind me. I took no notice, thinking a draft had lifted some curtain. But a minute later, another movement, almost indistinct, sent a disagreeable little shiver over my skin. It was so ridiculous to be moved thus, even so slightly, that I would not turn round, being ashamed. I had discovered the second package I needed, and was just on the point of reaching for the third, when a great and sorrowful sigh, close to my shoulder, made me give a mad leap 2 yards away. In my spring I had turned round, my hand on the hilt of my sword, and surely had I not felt that, I would have fled like a coward. A tall woman, dressed in white, was facing me, standing behind the chair in which I had sat a second before. Such a shudder ran through me, I almost fell back. Oh, no one who has not yet felt them can understand these gruesome and ridiculous terrors. The soul melts, your heart seems to stop, your whole body becomes limp like a sponge, and your innermost parts seem collapsing. I do not believe in ghosts, and yet I broke down before the hideous fear of the dead, and I suffered, oh, I suffered more in those few minutes, in the irresistible anguish of supernatural dread, than I have suffered in all the rest of my life. If she had not spoken, I might have died, but she did speak. She spoke in a soft and plaintive voice which set my nerves vibrating. I could not say that I regained my self-control. No, I was past knowing what I did, but the kind of pride I have in me, as well as a military pride, helped me to maintain, almost in spite of myself, an honorable countenance. I was making a pose for myself, and for her whatever she was, woman or phantom. I realized this later, for at the time of the apparition, I could think of nothing. I was afraid. She said, "Oh, you can be of great help to me, monsieur." I tried to answer, but I was unable to utter one word. A vague sound came from my throat. She continued, "Will you? You can save me. Cure me. I suffer terribly. I always suffer. I suffer. Oh, I suffer." And she sat down gently in my chair. She looked at me. "Will you?" I nodded my head, being still paralyzed. Then she handed me a woman's comb of tortoiseshell and murmured, "Comb my hair. Oh, comb my hair. That will cure me. Look at my head, how I suffer, and my hair, how it hurts." Her loose hair, very long, very black, it seemed to me, hung over the back of the chair, touching the floor. Why did I do it? Why did I, shivering, accept that comb? And why did I take between my hands her long hair, which left on my skin a ghastly impression of cold, as if I had handled serpents? I do not know. That feeling still clings about my fingers, and I shiver when I recall it. I combed her, I handled, I don't know how, that hair of ice. I bound and unbound it. I plaited it as one plaits a horse's mane. She sighed, bent her head, seemed happy. Suddenly she said, "Thank you," tore the comb from my hands, and fled through a door which I had noticed was half opened. Left alone, I had for a few seconds the hazy feeling of one awakening from a nightmare. Then I recovered myself. I ran to the window and broke the shutters by my furious assault. A stream of light poured in. I rushed to the door through which the being had gone. I found it locked and immovable. Then a fever of flight seized me, panic, the true panic of battle. I quickly grasped the three packages of letters from the open desk. I crossed the room running. I took the steps of the stairway four at a time. I found myself outside, I don't know how, and seeing my horse close by, I mounted it in one leap and left at a full gallop. I didn't stop till I reached home and drew up in front of my house. Having thrown the reins to my orderly, I flew to my room and locked myself in to think. Then, for an hour, I asked myself whether or not I had been the victim of a hallucination. Certainly, I must have had one of those nervous shocks and one of those brain disorders to give such a rise to miracles to which the supernatural owes its strength. And I had almost concluded that it was a vision, an illusion of my senses, when I came near to the window. My eyes by chance looked down. My tunic was covered with hairs, long women's hairs which had entangled themselves around the buttons. I took them off one by one and threw them out of the window with trembling fingers. I then called my orderly. I felt too perturbed, too moved to go see my friend on that day. Besides, I needed to think over what I should tell him. I had his letters delivered to him. He gave a receipt to the soldier. He inquired after me and was told that I was not well. I had a sunstroke or something. He seemed distressed. I went to see him the next day, early in the morning, bent on telling him the truth. He had gone out the evening before and had not come back. I returned the same day, but he was not to be seen. I waited a week. He did not come back. I notified the police. They searched for him everywhere, but no one could find any trace of his passing or of his retreat. A careful search was made in the deserted manor. No suspicious clue was discovered. There was no sign that a woman had been concealed there. The inquest gave no result, so the search went no further. And in 56 years, I have learned nothing more. I never found out the truth. And that, listeners, was the story, A Ghost. So, what do you think? Did this gentleman just see a woman who had been kept locked in a deserted chateau? Or was she really a ghost? I'd love to get your thoughts, so why don't you send me an email at hauntedhorrorhistorian@gmail.com or find me on any socials by searching Haunted Horror Historian. I'm afraid that's all we have time for this week, but until next time, my listeners, stay spooky, and remember, sometimes it's more than just a story.